Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rutolo, also known as Miss ADD, and I want to welcome you to my podcast today. I decided to continue our discussion on individuation, emotional individuation, growing up emotionally. And we did this, probably the initial podcast was about, 4 weeks ago. And what I am noticing in the adult support group that I'm running on Wednesday nights, for those of you who are in the Southern California area, on Wednesday nights for CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD, I'm on the board, I run this adult support group that has been going on now for close to 4 years, and it's Wednesday night at the Center for Learning Unlimited, 2785 Pacific Coast Highway, and it runs from 7:30 to 9 o'clock, and we usually go over. But anyway, we've been doing a lot of work over, the past 4 or 5 weeks on this whole process of growing up emotionally. And I wanted to share with everybody today the growth that's happening not only in that group, but with individual clients that I work with in Southern California as well. This is something that I came up with because I worked through this whole idea myself when I went through my own trauma and realized that a lot of the behaviors that were happening were not everybody else's fault, but were mine. I had to look at them. I had to become self-aware. I had to change. And in becoming self-aware, what I really noticed was that a lot of my behaviors were extremely juvenile. Emotionally, I was tethered still to a lot of things from my childhood, from my adolescent years, from my young adult years that I needed to be able to release. My psyche was really built on years and years of negative stuff that happened for me in my life. Not that I wasn't responsible for a lot of it. And I needed to do a lot of changing. I needed to change the psyche. I needed to step out of my comfort zone. I just needed to grow up emotionally. I knew that physically I was an adult, and I was also the parent of two boys, 26 and 22, now, at the time, a little younger. And so I just had to do this whole process. In doing it, what I recognized for myself was that I was then an adult, an emotional adult, so I was able to really get in control of the negative symptoms of ADD. So first and foremost, I was able to regulate my emotions, which is something big in this population. I was able to sit with feelings that would come up, maybe for a day or 2 days, something that was very difficult for me before I responded to the person that was involved with me at the time. And I'm not only talking about significant other relationships, but friendships and work relationships. And what I noticed is that in an adult-like way, being able to sit with that feeling or that emotion that I knew because of mindfulness was not me, but was separate of me, and I was just noticing that I was able to respond differently. I was able to respond to people now as an adult, very assertive and kind, which was something I was never able to do in my life because I was very explosive. When those emotions would come over me, I responded in a very juvenile way. And that was something I knew I needed to change, not only for myself, but more important, my children. In addition to that, I didn't procrastinate anymore. I was able to get things done. I was more focused, eventually able to come off all my stimulant medication, which I'm still off and doing very, very well. I was able to follow through. My creative side all of a sudden just started to really blossom because I was releasing a lot of fear and anxiety that I had lived with for years and years. So I can promise all of you who are listening, this is not a joke. This really works. And I have other people that I'm working with, both, as I said before, individually and in the group, that there's a lot of growth happening. And so just to remind all of you a little bit about what the individuation process is. I want to read something that I have given out to the group where we do this work. And the individuation process brings up the true identity of self. It makes them an individual, not tethered to anyone else. Tethered, you can look at that word as a codependent, so more like codependent. But tethered is a word that is a powerful word because we become very tied to individuals in our life that possibly had mental disorders, were not healthy, and that's what really holds us in this place of emotional juvenile behavior. Individuation has a profound healing effect on the psyche. People become adults, which helps them regulate their emotions, and ruminations, which are the thoughts that are running through our heads all the time. And in this whole process, what happens is the mindfulness piece of this is accepted, and we're not engaging with the thoughts in our head. We're just noticing them as if they were balloons that were flying above us or clouds in the sky. They are focused, calm, set goals, and follow through. They are able to take responsibility for their behaviors and embrace the need for help from professionals. And so by this I mean I've had a lot of people that have come into me, and when I give them tools to get better, they're not really capable of utilizing those tools because many of them are still very stuck in that emotional juvenile place because they have never individuated from these people in their lives that they were very tethered to. So they function at a much higher level and are able to give up control of anyone except themselves. So this is the process that we're working towards in the individuation group that we do on Wednesday nights, and as I said before, with people that I work with one-on-one. So I have a special guest that is going to be with us today, and he is in my group and also a client of mine. And I wanted him to come on the show with me because I really needed for him to talk a lot about this process, how it's been for him, the changes he's making, and how he's moving forward, progressing beautifully in this whole thing. So I want to introduce everybody to David. Is he on the line?
Hi, Justine. I'm on the line.
Hi, David. How are you? Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm so glad you're having me on the show, and love to share with your listeners what I'm working on, what you've been teaching me in both our private sessions and then also what you're teaching the group.
Okay. So, David, before you ever started this process, before you and I ever decided that we were going to work on this emotional individuation both privately and in the group, where were you at?
Well,
emotionally.
First off, I can say starting point was that I was completely lacking in self-awareness. So
okay.
I was not even aware of my immature emotionality and the way that I was really going through life reacting instead of responding in a healthy, measured way to people. So I think the first part was, and this was very difficult for me, was to feel all these emotions that I'd done a very good job just avoiding and suppressing. So when they started to come out, and I was examining them through a greater self-awareness, I was kind of confronted with this real immature behavior that I had been able to avoid acting out, but I wasn't really in a healthy way in engaging with people through a great part of my adult life because I did not. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So did you also notice that when you started to really begin to see these juvenile behaviors related to not being individuated emotionally, did you notice that your ADD symptoms were worse?
Yes, because
yeah.
I was not I was giving into the impulses. I was not regulating my emotions. And maybe it's just part of the process that I had to go through was to experience, because I had avoided it, this immaturity that I've come to realize now is a component of ADD and obviously in children, but most certainly in adults as well.
Exactly. And I think that what you and I notice is everybody else that's in the group really is just blown away by this whole idea because they never thought about it until I started to talk about it, bring it up, and discuss it.
No, absolutely, because there was no way to and what you've done is you've helped us to recognize a behavior in our group that it does exist, and we either have excused it, explained it away, or we just accept it with, well, that's just the way I am and I can't change, when really it's a matter of being confronted with this kind of behavior and examining it and realizing that we do have a choice and we can choose not to act this way.
Right. And so I think that what's happening in working through this whole process is that all of us are really beginning to see that our childhood, our adolescent years, really in many ways did a number on a lot of us. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of people out there, I haven't met many, who have had the perfect childhood where nobody in the family had any kind of mental disorders or substance abuse issues, and life was just completely perfect for them. But there aren't a lot of them out there, whether they're ADD or they're not ADD. So I think this whole process of just being able to go back, as I say, not stay there for a long time, but kind of look at what our lives were when we were children or adolescents, which helps us to really individuate emotionally in the present. So one of the things I wanted to for you to talk a little bit about for everybody who's listening is the steps that we're doing in this whole process. We started out with the self-awareness. So I handed out a sheet with a lot of different things on it for people to check off, some of them being like impulsivity, are they controlling, manipulative, judgmental, need to be right, low frustration tolerance, argumentative, scattered, depression. These just keep going on and on. And what I asked everybody in the group to do was to check off the ones that they believed in how much they knew about themselves, because most people who are not individuated emotionally don't have that sense of self, but to check off what they thought that they had, the behaviors that they had, or the feelings, whatever you want to call them, and then we're going to relook at that at the end of this whole process and see how that's going to change. And so could you talk a little bit about how that whole list of things for you, how that was for you, the self-awareness?
Oh, yes. I think when you put something down on a piece of paper and you list it and then you really take a look at it, it enables you to better confront yourself and acknowledge the state that you're in. Because I'm finding I can't really change unless I know what it, where I'm at right now. It's sort of like this is like a checklist to measure yourself to say, where are you right now? And so while on one hand, it can be very, not just disconcerting, maybe some people would be kind of depressing to think, oh gosh, look at all these things that I've got to work on. But it also, I think, enables us to get a handle on things because like a to-do list where you start doing one thing at a time and you check things off, you can start seeing improvement. And I think what you've given us is just kind of enabling each of us to establish a baseline of where we're at. And so we now can measure our improvement. And that what I'm beginning to see is that as I am making improvement, not on every single item, but on you know, one item at a time, it's encouraging me and giving me greater motivation to keep on going, and that's always good. I think that
right.
any major goal in life, it can
and
be.
And was there kind of a freedom? I mean, for me, even though it was difficult, as you just said, when I had to look at what was going on with me and admit to myself first and foremost and then to others who were important to me what I discovered about myself, in the beginning it was difficult, but then there was kind of a sense of freedom because I was releasing things that I had been holding on to for so many years about myself. Did you feel that at all?
Well, obviously, because you've been working for so many more years, and now that you help people with ADD, you're kind of like the sensei of the dojo.
That's pretty good. I like that.
Students, and so for me, I wouldn't say it's as freeing as much as I can now have a game plan. I think part of where I'm at, and maybe some people can identify with that, is that because I had a mechanism to avoid things and to not distract myself, but just not pay attention, writing this down is one step, but it has to be, for a person like myself, has to be revisited. Because I can write it down, but put the piece of paper away and not refer back to it, and then I can go back to my old patterns because that's what I'm used to, and I'm used to avoiding things. So what I'm trying to do is to keep this list in front of me, just like a list of any goals. You have to
right.
have them written down, and you have to have them in front of you at all times. Because otherwise, you know, what, like out of sight, out of mind. And
right,
that's
exactly.
what I have to avoid. So I think this process is harder for people to do. If you do it, what I have a tendency to do, and I'm working hard to overcome it, and that is, to not just stuff it in a folder and then file it away and then avoid facing it by not looking at it again. So I, as we're talking, I've actually pulled it up. I have it in a folder, and I have another book that I work on that I have to refer to every day, and these items are on the list. And by doing so, that's how I can continue to keep this in front of me so I can work on it.
Right, and so one of the things I remember that you and I talked about, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, is, you know, like, for example, with being able to get up and do things, okay, like I don't mean get up from your sleep, but during the day, instead of procrastinating, to get up and to just get things done. And you had mentioned to me that you were still struggling, even though you knew that the right thing for you to do would be to get up and to do what you needed to do, that you were still struggling. And one of the things I shared with you that I want to share with everybody else who's listening is that when you have a psyche that is built on, as they say in the untethered soul, bricks and mortar, for years and years and years of just dealing with negative situations or people in our lives that were critical, that's a big one for people with ADD, our psyche, as we're going to change, and we're changing the psyche at the same time, but that's another process that happens with this whole process, it kind of wants to pull us back. So we may go 2 days of getting things done and feeling really good and not procrastinating and being on task, and then all of a sudden the third day comes up and we fell back again. Do you remember that conversation that we had?
Well, absolutely, and that has certainly been my pattern, and so I'm working on that. You also gave a very good suggestion, and it works really well, especially for many of us that have to sit in front of a computer, either just the major part of our workday, or I think almost for everybody these days, at least a portion of your workday, we have to work on computers. And using a computer requires us, in many cases, to be working on many different things at once. And it's really easy, especially with the internet and news and emails coming in, to get distracted very quickly and thus get off task and get off track. And I
right.
found that what helps me, instead of telling myself, okay, shut this window down, don't, check your email later, let's get back to the task that's on your list, I'll actually kind of push the chair back, stand up, take a step back, stretch,
yep.
And, maybe even just get a drink of water. That physical action disengages me from that distraction that I was allowing myself to be occupied with. So
right.
It's not enough to just say, okay, I'm done with my email, I'm closing that window. It's that physical act. That helps. And I,
well, because it's a break. It's a whole break in the continuation of what you've been doing. So, for example, for myself, if I'm in the middle of something and I know I've got to move over and do something else that I really don't want to do because it's not creative and it's kind of boring and mundane and writing has never been something I really love to do, I stand up and tell myself, no, you're not going to procrastinate. You're going to get this done. You're going to sit back down in a few minutes after you take a little walk around the house and get back to it, because that whole break in the cycle of where we're at helps us to get on track again. And that's why I encourage everybody who's listening to use this when you're feeling like you really want to procrastinate or you're in the middle of procrastinating. Break that cycle, stand up, shake yourself off, do some meditating, or as Dave said, go get a glass of water. And yeah, that's something that can really, really help, and I'm glad it's working for you.
Yeah, and that's kind of I'll call it a mechanical process to employ. Where I still need a lot of work is to recognize and understand and process and let go of the emotional component, that emotional impulse that's tugging me at wanting to exit from what I'm doing, to not stay on task. That I think with ADD, because when a task is very kind of routine and we just know how to do it and it bores us, we want to be distracted. And there is, it's a weird thing. Before I just would go with it and wasn't even aware of it. Now I can observe it, but still the tug is quite strong. And
well, the tug is very strong because a lot of that too is related to what you just said, that strong emotional component that most people with ADD have, and most of us are very sensitive to, men and women. And I'm sure there's men out there who are saying, I'm not sensitive. Yes, you are, because it's all part of that juvenile emotional reaction. And so I can promise you that even though I am emotionally individuated now, I get things done probably better than the average bear. I still at times struggle with that emotional piece, because that is something that has been very big for all of us our whole lives. And that's what's happening. When you engage in that emotion instead of just notice it, like as mindfulness tells us to do, because the emotion is not part of you. The emotion is separate of you. It's the object. You're the subject.
Right. And I forget
so
that.
We use that, yeah.
But that is very true. And I think that why ADD people, and I've certainly been guilty of this going back to when I was in high school and certainly in college, is that work got pushed off to the very last minute, and there was such an urgency, such an angst, such a fear of doom because the paper's due the following day, and you, under tremendous emotional pain, you write the paper and you get it, typed up, and you hand it in the next day, and, just right under the wire. But it was not pleasant. But it's almost as if that emotional pain of doing something at the last minute kind of superseded that underlying pain that kind of prevents you from doing a lot of things. And when you don't procrastinate and you do things sooner, which is what I'm doing now, I don't have that, oh my goodness, the paper's due tomorrow, deadline kind of stress. I have a whole week to do something, but now I'm being confronted with my underlying emotion.
Right, which is, okay, so talk a little bit about that underlying emotion. What is it that gets you, that stops you, that freezes you? What is it? What's the emotion?
This is something I'm still trying to understand. So I'm going to kind of share with you and your audience what I'm beginning to see. I think there's a lot more self-awareness I have to gain and understanding of what's really going on.
Okay.
Part of it is, and this is where I guess we'll talk about the other steps you're taking as students, individuation, so I don't want to jump ahead, but it's strange that a lot of feelings that I have are really deeply rooted, and they do go back to childhood over things
right.
that when you were a child were quite traumatic and quite profound or had a great effect on you, that today, if you were to look at them and just examine them, or you were to witness it occur to a small child of that particular age today, you wouldn't think it that big of a deal. And yet it just gets hardwired into our system that certain
right.
feelings just start coming out. And now, instead of dealing with the task at hand and just enjoying being alive and getting something done and being productive, you're wrestling with these emotions that are coming up that came from your childhood. And I guess
right.
some learning from the intended soul, if you step outside, your emotions are not you. You can now recognize them and observe them and not have them entangle you. Because that part of it.
Okay, but here's the process. Here's the process. So the untethered soul, that process is amazing. And I use that in being able to release the negative energies from the past. Okay? We, in this whole process we're doing with the emotional individuation and growing up, that's what we're doing right now. The genogram that everybody talked about, mm-hmm. we are now back in the childhood, adolescent years of this criticism that we all lived with. And I'm wondering, as I'm just talking to you, I'm wondering something that I'm going to throw out to you. I'm wondering if part of your pushback sometimes with completely getting things done that you know you need to do for your success in your life, could it be directly related to the fear that's subconscious now of the criticism that you felt growing up, possibly when you did things that you didn't want to hear?
Yeah,
and that may be
on.
Buried in the psyche. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really spot on for this reason, that as a child, it wasn't all the time, but it certainly became a part of my upbringing. You would do something, and then, of course, you would get criticized.
Right.
And so it didn't matter what you did. It just wasn't good enough. And so to avoid the criticism, if you just put it off and didn't do it, you would just face a different sort of consequence. But after giving it your all and getting picked on and put down for what you did, you at least didn't face that. Now you just got yelled at because you didn't do something, and that's a whole different thing.
Right.
And it's also a way of being oppositionally defiant.
Well, and the other thing I'm thinking, too, is do we become tethered to that criticism because even though it's negative and it's critical, it's what we know. It's our homeostasis. So
as we got
older, we just said, hey, you know what, maybe I'm just not going to do this, and either our wives or our husbands or our work partners or our friends would then criticize us. And even though we didn't like that feeling, we were used to it. It was something that
right.
we got comfortable with.
I think it got so comfortable that even if there was nobody around to criticize it, we would self-criticize. We would do something,
yes.
and the whole time we were doing it, we'd be picking it apart, putting ourselves down and making excuses or just saying, well, you know, I tried, but it's not good enough. And so there was still this little voice in your head that was the tapes that you were given as a child, and now you're just self-playing them and putting yourself down. And so there was no enjoyment in doing the task because it just you knew you were going to get picked on, and if it wasn't a significant adult in your life when you were a child, you're going to do it to yourself. And so I'm now beginning to recognize that just to – except that I'm going to take this time, this moment right now, to work on a task, give it my best effort, and then just let's see what happens, and not pass a judgment on it while I'm doing it, and then certainly not even put a judgment on it when I complete it. Let that judgment come eventually, and with an objective sense of critique that's done kindly and gently towards yourself.
Right, and I also think that in understanding the whole process of not engaging in the judgment, the emotions, the thoughts, because see the thoughts are the things that really create those emotions that come up and the judgments. So if we can just stay in the mindfulness world too at the same time and just notice these things as they come up and go, oh, that's fascinating, I love that, and just keep moving forward as we continue this work, I think that that's part of what's going to rebuild the psyche also, because the psyche has been built on engaging in the ruminations, engaging in the emotions that come from that, engaging in the judgments that come up for us that were really put upon us as children or adolescents, living in that critical world where you were labeled lazy, stupid, procrastinator, whatever came up for you. So I think that that's another piece of this whole process, is we keep in mind as we're doing this work the mindfulness piece, which is staying in the moment and just not engaging in those thoughts as they come up. Do you agree with that?
Oh, very much so. I find when I do practice mindfulness, I really do enjoy myself more. Living in the moment, I feel like I'm present, I'm there, and I'm having kind of that joy in the moment that I've never really experienced. I always thought that I was a joyful person in the midst of all my adversity, and so it was just this joy while in pain and suffering. And
right.
I realize is not necessary. We don't, I mean, there are certainly adversity comes in life, but you don't have to perpetuate it and make that your constant state of being because you don't know how to transcend it. And so what you're saying by being in the moment, by observing that your emotions are really not you and all these ruminations, you can set those aside and you can observe those ruminations and then stop them and then get back to the moment.
Exactly. So now let's talk a little bit about the work that we've been doing the past couple of weeks with the genogram. So I want to explain to everybody who's listening that a genogram, you can go online and you can Google it, and you can look at how they're set up. And you start with your grandparents. For some people whose great-grandparents are still alive, I guess you'd have to be very young for that. But really with the grandparents. And you come down then to the parents and to their siblings and then down to you. And I want David to talk a little bit about what he's experienced, not only in yourself, but what other people have done in the group and the powerful reactions that we're getting from people when they're realizing the mental illnesses and the substance abuse. So would you be kind enough to speak about that?
Sure. I certainly got up for the group and shared my family career genealogy. And in some cases, it was kind of unremarkable. There was some, just to use a euphemism, I'll say eccentric people in my family. You can see that some people were functioning pretty well and others had difficulty in life.
There was some depression in your family.
I think that there was, I would call it more anxiety, not really depression.
Okay.
Other people in the group, it was very prevalent. I think in my family, if there's been depression, it was masked very well. But
let me just mention to you about your mother for a minute. One of the things that I can tell you about a dysthymia, which is a dysthymic disorder, which is a chronic depression. It's not a major depression. So sometimes I think we get confused because we think of depression as somebody who can't get out of bed. I had a dysthymic disorder, and one of the ways it manifests itself, and I think this is going to be big for you, is in low frustration tolerance. So when you think about the yelling that went on with your mom, there may have been a dysthymia there that you, at the time, of course, wouldn't have even recognized.
No, and I can recognize it now. Did not know that that would be the clinical term for it, but that kind of behavior was certainly exhibited. My mother had four sons, no daughters, and she was an only child, so didn't really have siblings to grow up with.
So that must have been very difficult for her, David,
when you think about it, that she
was an only child.
Yeah, and she really was. It was like we were too much for her, and with the energy we exhibited, and we really weren't real problem children. I think when you have more than two kids, you're going to have one. You can have some variances in behaviors, and that's just a nice way of saying that you got a black sheep in the family, or one kid that's going to be a heck of a lot more work than the other ones. And that was certainly in my mom's case, and. Typical American culture in that period of time where the father was off at work, the mom was stuck with the kids, and then, of course, as we move after women's liberation and women entering the workforce, well, now women had jobs and housekeeping chores and raising of children and the care and feeding of us. And so it was just, I think, overwhelming. My mother's generation
was... And was there criticism? You grew up with criticism, correct?
Yeah, but because that was considered normal to me, I just thought that criticism was normal. I had no idea that other people in families, things were done in a much more loving, kind, and gentle way. So I was used to having things done a little bit roughly with me, but being boys, we were tough, and it certainly toughened us up, but... being a person that really was much more sensitive than I had realized, it had its impact on me, and I can now see it in my brothers. And even though I think we're all pretty tough, it came at a price that made it. It's given us some difficulties in life that all of us are working on.
Right, and in terms of ADD. Because I think that's really what we're talking about here. In terms of ADD, I think that what we really want to talk about is the effect that this criticism, that these mental disorders, okay, and again, I don't mean to say that anybody in your family or anybody else listening had severe mental disorders. If there was, so be it. But most of the time we're talking about anxiety, and a form of mild depression. And I think what happens was when people are struggling with this, I talked about this last week in the podcast because I had gone up to San Francisco, and I'll share this very quickly, and I ran into, when we were leaving, a family of four children and a mother and father, and they were yelling at the children in the car. And so I met my son and his girlfriend for breakfast and said to him, I just wanted to throw it out. Do we have children just to yell at them? And it was just something that had come up into my head. And, my son, being very astute and very bright, said, if you look at human nature, we're selfish individuals, and especially in America, because this is an individualistic society. And so years ago, when things were very different than they are today, and your mom and my mom and tons of moms were stay-at-home moms, and some of them had educations, and I'm sure that there was some frustration there of having to stay home and raise children, even though they love their kids, but there was something that was missing for them, and they kind of felt like, I stayed home to raise these kids, and we have all these issues and problems and layer on top of that ADD, who possibly years ago in the Stone Age, as I like to say, nobody knew about it, So there was added frustration there. So we dealt with, as kids today with attention deficit disorder deal with, a lot of criticism because parents have a difficult time using communication, clear, loving, kind communication with their children to really help them move forward.
And I think almost all parents would agree with you on what you're saying, that we deal with our children kindly and gently. But being a parent in actuality, and again, I can only go by my observations. My wife and I, we do not have children of our own.
Right.
But I am very sympathetic for all my friends who have children, all the way from now very young infants all the way up to kids that are now they're empty nest parents, the kids are off to college or even a little bit beyond. And it is truly a thank job. You are not appreciated. And as one person once said to me, if you only had to tell your kid something once instead of 9,643 times to stop doing something or to do something, if it only took once, being a parent would be unnecessary. So I guess parents are required to tell their children 1,000 times what needs to be done.
I think there has to be a negotiation. I think that what parents kind of miss out on sometimes is we don't need to bring our own anxiety into this relationship and deal with our children in a negative way. I think,
well, wouldn't that
you know,
be that, because again, I didn't learn this as a kid growing up, so my parents weren't taught this life skill.
Right,
or,
right. I'm talking about today.
My emotions are not me, and here I am getting very frustrated with my kid. He just broke something, messed something. I specifically told him not to. He willfully or inadvertently, forgetfully did it anyway. I have to clean up a mess, and I have all these other things upon me. And just, I think any children, some more than others, can exasperate any sane adult to the breaking point. And so
If you look at the attachment thing that we discussed a couple weeks ago, which we're going to get into now,
mm-hmm.
the whole attachment of how kids attach to their parents, especially when they're very young, you're going to see oppositional defiant behavior when there isn't secure attachment. So from the time the child was very – what?
Yes, I totally agree with that. I think that's just, I know you're starting to work, you say you have a new class now working specifically with adults, with children who have ADD, and that
right.
is certainly a skill that needs to be taught, and a lot of the literature, articles and stuff you find about ADD that's written by different news organizations, they're not touching on really any of the stuff you're bringing up, but I think teaching parents how to deal with an oppositionally defiant child in a very loving and kind way is much more effective than the kid to knock down and bend to your will.
Right.
And that's certainly
what
I was exposed to as a kid growing up.
I think I think what parents need to understand is that the insecure attachment that develops when a child is a baby. For some reason, there wasn't that very secure attachment to the caregivers. And the child then becomes very angry through this whole process and starts to blame themselves. This is all subconscious for those who are listening. Starts to blame themselves for the kind of negative relationship that's happening with the parent. The parent's getting angry at the child and yelling at the child. And so in order to secure that in their own mind and psyche and subconscious, they then act out more so that other people around can also say, oh, your behavior's terrible, or you're a bad kid, or whatever they're going to say. And that kind of, cements it for them. And that's where you get that oppositional defiant, which many of us have had in our lives. We've experienced it. We've lived it firsthand, not only as parents. I'm talking about kids, how we behaved because of feeling that insecure attachment. And especially years ago, I don't know about you if you remember this, but we were told by my own father when my son was born that, you know, don't pick him up too much because you're going to spoil him. So if my father's saying that to me, then that's what they laid me in a crib and wrapped me in swaddling clothes and left me there for a while. You know, it wasn't the same as it is today where we're always picking up our kids and hugging them and walking around with them. So more of our generation experienced more of that insecure attachment, I guess I could say. So where
I totally agree with that. I think it's just anecdotal, my own personal experience being kind of a middle child, having older and younger siblings. The child that acted up the most, of course, gets the most attention, and the ones that can kind of behave, they get left alone. And for some reason, it was my temperament as a small child to be fairly, demanding. And so I was kind of left to my own devices. And my parents remarked just years later, said, "Oh, you were just a very well-behaved child. We could leave you in your crib for hours and didn't fuss at all." But that meant I was left alone for hours, and I wasn't getting any attention. And so looking back now, I think I needed more. And I think what the parents, especially my first generation, they just had no idea that each child has a different, almost like they're hardwired in the same way we are born with a certain color hair or certain color eyes and skin tone. We are wired with a certain emotionality, but all children need that attention, and some more than others. Some are just highly sensitive that really truly need more picking up, more more care than other children. And so the parent, you know, can't really know. And if you got multiple children, you're already hard pressed. And so I really think for a lot of the parents, especially my parents' generation, and I think even for young parents today, there's just a greater need for education for the parents and support and helping the parents gain the skills. So I definitely think the things you're teaching, this message needs to get out to more people. So the parents know, look, it's not that you're a bad parent, you've messed up, it's just this is the way we are wired, and we need to do these things for our children from the time they are born. And it can be done, and I think we can break the cycle. But I think several generations ago, especially certain cultures more than others, children were handled quite roughly. I mean, corporal punishment.
Right, and they didn't understand attention deficit disorder, so... You know, I was, of course, you know, called Sister Mary Victrola because I talked too much, you know, and I was told by my first grade nun teacher told my mother that I was a procrastinator, which I find really fascinating when you think about back in first grade. They were picking that up. Right.
Yeah,
but I guess one.
Labels.
Well, they didn't care. The nuns didn't care what kind of labels they put on the kids. But I guess it's just true. I'm speaking the truth. But anyway, I guess what I wanted to get back to for a minute was I've noticed in the group that other people who have shared their genograms and have talked about grandparents and parents and their parents' siblings, so aunts and uncles of theirs and all, that it's really been eye-opening for them to really experience, many of them for the first time, because they've never shared with anybody else this information, but just how much either mental illness or more than that, substance abuse that went on in the families.
Oh,
and
I have to agree. That was amazing. Some of the people and what some of the people did was really, they made a graphic. They actually made a chart and they color-coded it. And so you can see just at a glance the people that had drug abuse problems, alcohol problems, mental illness problems, depression problems.
Right.
And you could see that it carried across the family gene and then down through the generations. But what's interesting to know is that people like myself who didn't have the alcoholism or the drug abuse, we still had a dysfunction. So we could all relate to one another. And it became more apparent that with more dysfunction and trauma in the family, you're going to have more ADD.
Right. And so in that whole dysfunction, I think what people are beginning to recognize, as I'm going to bring up about you in a minute, is how we become tethered, especially to these people in our lives who have been critical. Mm-hmm. And in the tethering process, what we're trying to do is figure out a way to change that criticism to positive thing. And and no matter how hard we tried, that didn't happen. It you know, periodically we could have gotten a little, oh, good job. But most of the time, what all of us, from what I can see, heard was a lot of criticism and a lot of secrets in the family. I mean, a lot of people had to ask siblings or aunts or uncles to really figure out what was wrong with mom or what was wrong with grandma. And I find that in our generation, especially, and I'm 58, so I would say anywhere from probably 40, 45 to 58, that kind of generation right there, there were a lot of secrets. We didn't talk openly about mental disorders or substance abuse, and many of the people that shared were hiding in closets because their fathers were having rages or their mothers from the drinking. Or so I just, this has been an eye-opener for everybody who's been doing this, because they're beginning to see how their ADD symptoms were exacerbated many times because of all this flux that went on in the family.
No, I totally agree. One other element that came out was the fact that family members, fathers, grandfathers who had the, I'll call it the misfortune of being drafted and fighting in a war, and then
right.
actually, you know, being in combat, and so they were, you know, being fired upon, and then had to fight in actual combat, as opposed to, you know, just being on a supply ship and never being shot upon. And if we look at they talk about the greatest generation, and out of 12 million people in uniform, maybe only less than 2 million were actually shot upon. It just to raise that size of an army, you needed all those support people. And growing up with, as a boy, my parents' generation were part of that. Not that many fathers really actually fought. And the ones that did, now as I look back, and of course it came out in our group meetings, those were the guys that came back, became rageaholics. They were
PTSD, yeah.
And it was
yeah.
PTSD. And what's sad is we're seeing a lot of these young men today, I call them young, they're teenagers in their 20s to early 30s, who are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan and all these other, you know, this worldwide war on terror. They're being traumatized. And so I fear for their families and their children, because they are unfortunately repeating the same patterns that the men who came back from Europe and the Pacific war against the Japanese were also going through. Oh, and Vietnam as well.
Well,
they,
I think that's what's happening. Yeah, go ahead.
So my point is that not that, you know, I'm not going to get on and criticize the military. It's not something done today, but we can at least have a sober look at things and just
yeah.
admit we got a problem here. And people
right. I think we're getting off track a little bit, but let me just say this. I do blame the military. I blame our government, and I hope they're all listening to this, because constantly, war after war after war, there's never enough done for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. For those of you who don't know what this is, it's caused by horrific situations where you see people die, and you might have been one of those people, and so it's a fear of, you know, this happening to you, and so you have flashbacks all the time. And when I worked with vets from the Vietnam War, when I was getting my hours towards my license, these gentlemen, and I call them gentlemen because they served for our country, told me that when they came back, I asked them, were you processed out? Oh, yes, we were sent to Seattle for 30 days and we watched cartoons. So, yes, I am angry at the government, and I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but
no,
it's still happening today.
Yeah, it is.
So,
well, I think where what the solution is people such as yourself are coming up with, I think, the tools and the, you know, group of people that can help them. And so I think these people are going to finally get help after generations of this being either swept under the rug, you know, people put in the back room and forgotten. I think we
right.
can now deal with this. And then we can have an
right.
honest discussion and recognize that the nature of war today, certainly, and also in the past, is very damaging, not just to the individual soldiers, but to their families and future generations.
Right. Okay, so let's get off that now because we got off tangent. Sorry, everybody, but it was really, really important because we do have somebody that was in our group on Wednesday night whose father was very frightening to him. He's a gentleman in his 50s, and he came to find out from years after his father passed away that his father actually was a very gentle, kind person before he went off to World War II. Okay, so one of the exercises that I gave to everybody on Wednesday night was I asked them, what was your role in the family? If you remember that, David and I talked about the identified patient. So in family therapy, there is the identified patient. I, in my family, being the baby, was the identified patient. I was the one who got into trouble. I mean, I was never arrested. I never got into that kind of trouble, but I would talk a lot in school and, you know, I was depressed. I know I was depressed as a child and had some issues of my own, and a lot of it related to what happened, you know, the dynamic in my family. But so I consider myself to be the identified patient. You, David, considered yourself to be the one who kind of flew under the radar, right? Didn't get in trouble much.
Yeah, I had a brother who was the IP for the family. He was the one recognized as being, and this was, you know, a long time years ago when it was just being new, but he was classic, you know, ADD child. He was probably one of the first kids in the 60s that was put on Ritalin. And so all the attention was on him. So that really took pressure off of me, so I could fly under the radar. One of the things that you said that I've been really ruminating on in a good way, you know, rumination of the other thoughts was not good, but that was that we all take on a role to protect ourselves in our crazy, if you want to call it, dysfunctional families.
Right.
And so this role that we play as a child, it served us then, but it doesn't help us now as an adult if we continue to play that role.
And that's what I think all of this, looking back on this, that's where I think we're getting to. This is what's really going to help us all in the group and individually with people I work with really start to get to this place of doing the ahas. Okay, now I see I was the identified patient. I'm a lot healthier, and I am very individuated emotionally, so I can't even relate back to that. I can remember it, but I am not there anymore, and I was the IP, I would have to tell you, throughout my life until I got healthy. So the role in the family is really, I think, who we end up being as we get older, when we're physically growing up, but emotionally we're not. And I think that understanding of how it affected us growing up in the family and taking on these roles that we took on can really help us then to untether ourselves from the situation, the people, even if they're dead, and then start the process of really growing up emotionally. So that being said, how did your role affect you?
Well, I think for me, I had to cope with the criticism and it's kind of, you know, the negative sanctions that were put upon me. And I remember vividly as a child, I had an older brother who was hard to keep up with, and so I couldn't compete for the attention he received because he was older, smarter, bigger, stronger. And I had a younger brother who was always messing up, and he got lots of attention, was on the negative type. And I remember making the conscious decision to be good so I could avoid the negative sanctions. And then just to be quiet and to, you know, be the middle child and be willing to accept being ignored. And that was better. I mean, it's not what I wanted emotionally, but that was better than getting negative attention. And yet I was a real motor mouth as a child. That would get me into trouble, and so I was constantly telling myself to shut up. And that kind of, you know, suppressed character development is not good. But that was
right.
My way of functioning. And then also when you talk too much and you ask too many questions,
right,
that also does not allow you to learn, you know, be allowed to sit, to be valued as an individual, and that your opinion counts, and to express yourself. But see, I wasn't given the training to say, look, you have something to say, but here's the right way to do it. You don't interrupt, you don't blurt things out, you wait your turn. But that's to be done kindly and gently instead of yelling at somebody to shut up and knock it off.
Exactly, exactly. So, but let me ask you something, though. This whole idea of, you know, that you didn't feel like you were really able to ask questions because I'm sure that came from your own insecurity of dealing with the people in your family that affected you that way. Bring me into your adulthood, and how did that affect you in your adult years, your physical adult years?
I think I'm still coming to grips with that. How I'm beginning to recognize it is I learned how to do things on my own, not to ask for help, to kind of suffer in silence, not to express my feelings, to stuff things, and to kind of cope with things on my own. And so it stunted my ability to open myself up to people in a healthy way. And it also prevented me from being open to other people opening up to me. I think it definitely stunted me emotionally. I didn't get married until late in life. I was single for many, many years. I got married
right.
in my 40s.
So I
think
that
has direct effect.
Oh, I think it did. And I also think that part of you stuffing a lot of those emotions and feelings that you had, instead of really talking about them and getting them out, they get stuck up in your head, and there's the ruminations. And when we're ruminating all day long, and we're engaging with the thoughts and the feelings and the emotions, we're not getting anything done because we can't seem to move forward to get the work done that we know we need to do because we're stuck.
Yeah, I'm beginning to see also that when you allow this kind of thought process to build up, the backup, if you want to call it, as you get older, it creates a greater burden or weight on your personality, your psyche, and if you actually get less effective. I think this is why I'm feeling so hopeful, that I have the opportunity now to clean house inside
yes.
my head, and to let go of things that I've allowed to accumulate, because I did not have the mechanism to let go of things, to process things, and to move on. And
right.
in the same way, if you have a house and you keep on accumulating, you never do a proper spring cleaning, after a while you have trouble, you know, walking through your own house because you got too much junk in it. And I think that's what ADD, those that are middle, they're older, we have a lot of clutter in our head that needs to get cleared out.
Right, and that's what I talked about in the very beginning of the show when I talked about the untethered soul. And one of the things that Michael Singer talks about, which I think is so powerful, is releasing that negative energy from the past and running it through your heart so it doesn't get caught up in your head, and then being able to move on. But I truly believe that for people with attention deficit disorder who get really stuck, and they're the ones that ruminate more than, I believe, any other population, those ruminations can be our rumination in so many ways. So in order to be able to release those negative energies from the past, we got to do some, as you said, house cleaning. And this is what we're doing. We're doing the house cleaning in the individuation process. We're looking back. We're not staying here for a long time. We're identifying things that most of us never really saw or knew. And
right.
we're deciding, gee, how did those roles that I played in the family affect me? There's people who talked about being the family clown, and that was something else I was too. I always was the one who would entertain and make people laugh. And, you know, so much of that was because I was looking and searching for positive attention, and that's the way I would get it, was through that. So all of these things that we're sharing is the way out, the way to becoming emotionally individuated, growing up, and being able to live our lives more comfortably, peaceful, happy. And so where in this whole process of individuation, where would you say you're at this moment?
Well, I think we talked about this a week or two ago, and that is I was feeling a little bit of frustration because I kind of see the goal, that, and that is to achieve adulthood. But I feel like I'm in second grade, and I'm trying to graduate from high school or enter college, and I still need to get from second grade to third grade. And
okay.
So I'm beginning to break it down, say I got to go from second, third, to fourth, to fifth grade, and not to drag this thing out, but to realize that things come in increments. Things have to be done step by step. I'm not looking for a this grand epiphany or this great transformation that's going to come by this profound understanding that's going to wash over me and all of a sudden I'm just going to get it. I think it's just the daily exercise of these skills that help. And we mentioned, talk about cleaning house. I just want to point out how the group really helps those of us with ADD and ADHD, because one of the things I've observed in myself, and I found it common, people with ADD, and that is the ability to deal with clutter, to organize, to file, to put papers away, to, you know, it's either file, toss, or give away.
Right.
ADD people do best when somebody else is helping them. They don't really do a good job doing cleanup in the garage or the whatever they have to file or put a cleanup by themselves. And so in the group, it's sort of like getting help. It's like we're all doing some housekeeping, mental housekeeping, and we're doing it together, and that, I find, helps me a lot more than just trying to do this on my own. So for anybody who's trying to do it on their own, more power to you, but it's hard for us in our
population. It's very hard. You're right, because I think what happens in the group is we really encourage, that's the word. There's no criticism in our group. There's all positive stuff. We're all very loving, and we're sympathetic and empathetic. We all can empathize with each other, and we're all there for each other. And that, I think, is the beauty.
I don't know if you've mentioned this on air, but there's a number of people who come to the group who don't have ADD. They either have a spouse or a sibling, older or younger brother or sister.
I don't think I did mention it.
Them. And so,
which is great.
Those people who don't have ADD, they have a lot to offer, and I just have such admiration for these people that they have a loving sibling that cares about them enough to take the time and effort to help their brother or sister in the group. And I don't think they realize it, but obviously it certainly helps the sibling who has their brother or sister there to support them. But really, I feel there's support for me too, that the mere fact that they're there for the whole group, and it kind of puts us all together. It isn't just that, we got all the ADD people, we're shuttled off to our own room trying to help ourselves, and then there's all the normal people out there that don't have our problems. But we're all
But you know what,
together.
Though, David, if you really think about it, this work that I'm doing with you guys in this group, there are plenty of people that you know and I know that are not ADD that would benefit from this work. Because
there are
a lot of people out there who are non-ADD who are not individuated, emotionally individuated, and adults. So
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You ask.
I was just saying that one of the things that I've read is that almost everybody who has ADD or ADHD has issues with anxiety and depression. But not everybody who has anxiety issues is ADD. But it seems like a lot of the work that we're doing is helping people overcome anxiety and depression, which is helpful for every, you know, both ADD and non-ADD people who suffer from anxiety and depression.
Right.
So I totally agree with you.
Yeah, ultimately where we're going with this, and this is what happened to me, and again, I started my walk, this journey for me started 4 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, 4.5 years ago, and it took me probably a year to a year and a half where I could say that I really, really became emotionally individuated. So where we're going is we're all heading towards this nirvana place of being in control of our negative symptoms and our creative side just going crazy at that point, because the fear is released, the anxiety is released, we're emotionally individuated, we're now all adults, we're feeling great, but this is a process and it takes time. And when people come to me individually and they want me to fix them, I say, that is not what I do. I don't fix anybody. I can't fix people in the group. I can't fix people individually. I could only fix myself. I can give you the tools that I've given to myself to get me to this place of being emotionally individuated, but I can't do it for you. And that's the piece when I talk about the difference between being grown up and being juvenile. Because when you're juvenile and you try to get into coaching or therapy, you're expecting that person, because you're still young emotionally, to fix you. And it doesn't work that way.
I totally agree with that. And that's something you definitely stress in our sessions, both group and individually. I'm just, you know, taking the steps to do it. And the same way in the normal development of a child to an adult, it's a span of, you know, from the time of birth to the legal age of adulthood, 18 years, or maybe even go a little further, that takes years. And so I think what we have is the ability as adults to, it doesn't need to take 18 years. You mentioned your process took you about 4 years.
Right.
But still, it's not something that can...
It was really a year and a half. Because, I mean, I work on myself every day with the mindfulness and staying in the moment and not engaging with my thoughts. But the process of really growing up, individuating, and becoming emotionally secure and adult and not tethered to anybody took me about a year and a half, I would say. And then after that, I just kept building and building and building on it. Now, for everybody who's listening, and I've said this to group, don't get me wrong, there are days that I have, like everybody else, where I can slip back a little bit, but I'm really good at pulling myself right back out and saying, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to just keep moving forward, because you feel good. Because when you're an adult and you're emotionally individuated, it is the best feeling in the world. Your relationships are beautiful, not only your intimate relationships, but your friendships, your business relationships. You feel good, and here's the thing, you have internal validation, and that is nirvana. When you don't have to look outside yourself for validation, that is when you're totally secure in who you are, because you know who you are.
Well, to use a religious term, I'll say amen. So,
yeah, because
no, you're,
yeah,
we
talked
to the choir. I'm just taking the steps. I feel I'm still at the beginning of this process, and so in the next year or so, as I move forward, we're going to have both myself and a lot of other people that can relate. Like I'm trying to explain today, you know, what we're going through and what we've been able to accomplish. So I'm really excited about this program. The program towards individuation and the steps that we're going forward. I think today we just talked about the self-awareness. We talked about the genealogy, how that is a tool to help us recognize.
So let's talk for a minute, if you wouldn't mind, because we have a few minutes,
sure.
about the mask. So what I did was I gave out a paper plate to everybody in the group, and I asked them on the front of the plate, the side of the plate, the front of the mask that you would show to everybody, who is it that you show? And the back of the mask was the authentic self as you knew who you were at that point in time. So the authentic part, the part that we hide from people. So what was your mask? Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, I do. That was really quite powerful, because I think to sum it up, I can give you some specifics, but how I relate to the mask is it helps us to differentiate how we try to present ourselves to the rest of the world as one type of person, but on the inside we see ourselves as a totally different person. And because of the negativity and the criticism that we grew up with, that inside mask is one that really contains all of our negative traits, those that we actually do exhibit, and then just the labels that we place upon ourselves that other people don't necessarily place upon us as adults, because these were labels that were given to us when we were children. And so on the outside, of course, it's like we're always trying to put our best face forward, so we're going to try to show people that we're confident and that we're smart.
Right.
And that we're fearless and we're strong and we're outgoing and we're, you know, flexible and tolerant. We can put a bunch of things. But on the inside, what we're hiding from people is our anxieties, our anxiousness, the fact that
right.
we feel overwhelmed at times, that we have anger, we have rage, we can be scattered, unfocused, we
right.
feel we're kind of stumbling through things, or that we're paralyzed. And then just feeling our frustrations, that we have kind of an unfinished life, we're unfulfilled, we're imperfect. We're also showing our vulnerability that we don't want to, we not show, but we hide our vulnerability, that we fear rejection. We don't want to be abandoned. We're seeking approval to an excessive degree that's really not healthy. And so as a result, we're going to say yes to everybody. And we're trying to please people all the time. And
right.
that, of course,
and what I noticed is across the board with the masks that, which was very interesting, is that there was more than one mask that was being worn during the day. So there might have been a mask that was worn at work, and then one when they got home, or one when they go to church. So some people could have as many as 5 or 6 masks, depending on what they do. But then on top of that, what I noticed was the front of the mask was pretty much, I guess, the same kind of person that you wanted to show everybody that you were secure and, you know, you could follow through and you didn't procrastinate and you were grandiose or charismatic or whatever. But the back of the mask, what I noticed, and I think everybody noticed this, is that across the board, we really had people with anxiety and depression and insecurities and, you know, just negative thoughts and all the same things, which really leads me to believe that there's so much healing that needs to happen in order for all these people to really emotionally individuate. So I'm sure you saw that too.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at this mask exercise as one that to reconcile the outside and the inside so that you can become a whole human being.
Exactly.
Express to other people in your outward actions, behaviors, your words, that you also on the inside have that same, those characteristics are evident inside of you. They are not just a mask, but they become your core values and principles of how you operate. And I think when you fill yourself up with these positive traits, it can help to push out the negative inside traits that we have carried with us our whole lives. And
that's very good.
Don't have a choice to.
It's excellent. I'll give you an example. So because I have internal validation, the other day on Thursday, I was having what I like to call a very ADD more than moment. It was a half of a day. And I was supposed to be somewhere with somebody, and instead of lying and saying, you know, I really want to do, I was doing something else, I told them the truth. I said, look, I'm having an ADD morning and I just really can't pull it together right now. to get out and to come and to see you. This was not a client. This was a personal situation. And I felt really good. It made me feel good to be able to be honest and to say that instead of making up a story, because I didn't feel good about the fact that for those couple hours on Thursday, I was having a difficult time related to the fact that my son, who's up in San Francisco and bipolar, is struggling a little bit right now with depression and cannot find an antidepressant, so is trying to do the holistic route, and I'm concerned about him. And when I get, these are the only two people that can really make me scattered right now are my two boys. When something's going on with them, I tend to engage in the thoughts more than I do.
I guess all parents have that, I call it a weakness, but just the tendency to their children or what can preoccupy them, and
right.
It becomes a difficult. It's just parents, as they always say, that you know, you're always going to worry about your children no matter what the age they're at. And,
exactly.
And that's what I hear you saying.
Yes, and but the point of the story was really that I was able to tell somebody and feel comfortable and kind of happy about being able to say, look, I can't meet you because I'm really having some ADD moments and I can't seem to pull it together. And I was okay with that. And that's where the internal validation comes in.
Okay, but how about somebody who's truly not ADD, worried about their kids, they can't really do all the other things that they originally planned to do for the day, and they've got to deal with, you know, their emotional issues with their children. I mean, they don't have the same excuse. What can they say?
Well, I mean, for people who are not ADD, they have to be honest, too. Look, I'm having, you know, I ultimately told this person what this was about. I didn't just leave it at that. I did explain to this person that this is about my son, and, of course, they understood completely. But and who are, people out there who are not ADD who are listening can absolutely be just as honest. You know, I think we get ourselves into trouble when we're not honest and we say yes, yes, yes to things that we really need to say no, no, no to.
Yeah, I think within the ADD population, because of the stresses, we part of our coping mechanisms can be to be deceitful, to make excuses, because, again, we're behaving like adolescents. We're not acting like adults, and we're trying to avoid pain. And in many cases, people lie, and they bend the truth. I just call it lying, because it helps them to avoid that emotional pain temporarily.
And the fact that you brought that up brings up the fact that so many of the people who shared their genograms, that there were so many substance abusers in their family because they were medicating their pain.
Right. And the thing I was surprised to learn, because I thought I had the idyllic childhood. It was a little, you know, rough and tough. I thought, well, we were boys, and that's the way you raise boys. But I just developed all these coping mechanisms to deal with pain. I've just known other people who had similar upbringings to me. They got into drugs or alcohol, and they were just self-medicating. And I think it's well recognized. A lot of people in just the general population or in our culture today, we talk about people using alcohol and drugs as self-medicating.
Right.
So there is something to it, and it isn't just a cultural observation. I think there is a real basis for it, and I think it's...
No, there is. There really is, and I truly believe that it's a disease, and it's very sad, and this is what happens. So, David, I can't believe it, but the show is almost over, and I really want to thank you so much for being on the show and for spending time and talking about yourself. I'm sure everybody out there appreciates it as much as I do. So we're gonna end now, and I'd like to have you back on in a couple of weeks so that, you know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks down the road as we're doing more of this and you can talk about your progress.
Okay, so I have some accountability here. That's...
Yes, you do, to everybody out
okay.
there.
Okay, well, then I will take that as an adult and be responsible and proactive and continue to work on myself so I can... Show some progress. So I
okay.
I look forward to- being on your.
Thank you, David. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. So we only have about 6 minutes left. I'm not going to be able to do the questions. There's a few questions that I have. I'm not going to be able to fit them in. But I definitely, we're going to continue this individuation, not next week, but as I said, maybe 3 or 4 weeks down the road as we continue a group and individually as I work with more people so that all of you can hear all about the positive things that are happening, how people are moving forward, people are doing so well. So again, I want to thank everybody who listened today. Anybody in the next show next Sunday who wants to call in, the number is 917-889-7025. I'm not sure yet exactly what the next show is going to be, but during the week what happens is things come up and I just decide to either ask people to be on the show or come up with a topic, depending on what I'm doing. Also, during the week, if you have any questions for me, you can go to my website at missadd.com, click on my forum section, and you can ask any question you want. It doesn't have to be about the topic that we discussed today or last week or the week before, although they're on there. Just ask me any questions, and I'll answer you either on the show or privately back to you in the forum. Also, I have a Facebook page, Miss ADD, and if you all would be kind enough to go and look there, I post a lot of things there. We can even have conversations, and you can like my page. I'm also on Twitter. Miss ADD is my handle, and I have a lot of followers now, and I have been tweeting. I've been trying to tweet every day something positive or funny or informative for people to listen to. And last but not least, I am in the South Bay. I am in Palos Verdes and Torrance and Hermosa Beach, Redondo Beach, Manhattan Beach, wherever you are. If you want to come to our adult support group, please do so on Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9 at the Center for Learning Unlimited. There's a lot of growth happening, and if you need to see me privately, you can contact me either on my website or on my Facebook page, or you can email me at justine@missadd.com. So again, I want to thank everybody who listened today, and I look forward to being back next Sunday. This is Justine Rutolo, also known as Miss ADD, and I just want to remind all of you to stay in the moment. Thank you. Have a great Sunday.